The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Most of America is lifting COVID restrictions. One of the world's biggest cities has been shut down. Shanghai, home to about 25 million people, is largely at a standstill today as China battles its worst wave of COVID infections since the start of this global pandemic in 2020.
If we want lower gas prices, we need to have more oil supply right now.
President Biden Thursday announced an unprecedented effort to ease the pain at the pumps, placing the blame for recent hikes squarely on Russia's war in Ukraine.
Our prices are rising because of Putin's action.
The plan includes releasing 1 million barrels of oil every day through October from the nation's strategic petroleum reserve.
It'll have some impact, but perhaps not the impact that people suspect.
Oil analyst Tom Closer said while drivers will see a modest dip in prices, they aren't plunging anytime soon.
How much of the price increase that Americans are experiencing right now is related to Ukraine? How much is still global? Oil supplies, and maybe other factors.
There is some level of accuracy as referring to the last 2 months of increases as being associated with Putin. Now, having said that, gas prices were already fairly high prior.
How bad is the global shortage of fertilizer right now?
We are absolutely facing a problem of catastrophic proportion here. Not only is the issue lack of availability and affordability of nutrients and inputs, but also Russia and Ukraine have historically exported about 30% of global wheat trade and 20% of global corn trade. And there are stocks that are not getting out of the market because the Black Sea is closed. And we do not expect Ukraine to plant a normal crop next year due to damage of fuel depots, infrastructure, farm equipment, and dislocation of people. So to take a very tight food situation and just multiply it tenfold by a lack of production coming out of the world. This is a problem of epic proportion.
I want to get to treasuries because the market's getting a sign that a recession could be on the horizon. It's what everybody's talking about. The yield curve inverting after the closing bell.
The markets think the Fed will raise rates too high and too quickly, prompting a recession and then require an easing. That's why the longer end of the curve drops. The trouble is, recessions follow inversions anywhere from 6 months to 2 years later. So start your clocks now.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Gasoline prices continue to climb to the highest levels in history as the administration's anti-fossil fuel policies, along with the war in Ukraine, drive prices higher. Inflation now permeates from rising food, water, and utilities. The price of everything is going up as inflation becomes issue number one in the economy. Treasury yields are also rising, driving up mortgage rates, which is now impacting the housing market, and we're now starting to hear for the first time of a possible recession. The major indexes closed out the quarter with the biggest quarterly decline since the start of 2020, with losses of 5% or more. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up today, Robin Griffith joins me. Robin sees a big market storm ahead of us. He likes commodities as he sees inflation moving higher. Later on, Edward Dowd joins me. Dowd was one of BlackRock's top fund managers. He now runs his own hedge fund as we look at the possibility of fraud and a cover-up in the drug industry. Finally, Chris Poplava will be here with another edition of Smart Macro. But first, let's look at what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
To kick things off, let's talk about performance this week. The S&P 500 barely moved, up 0.1%. The Dow Industrial Average was down 0.1%, while the NASDAQ Composite rose 0.7%, and the Russell 2000 Small Cap Index rose 0.6%. Now, looking at sector performance, defensive areas outperformed, with real estate up 4.4%, utilities up 3.7%, and consumer staples up 2.3%. These areas do well when investors sniff out economic weakness and interest rates begin to fall. The more economically sensitive areas were actually down for the week. Financials, hurt by the flattening and inversion in some parts of the yield curve, more on that later, were down 3.3%. Energy was down 2.4%, and industrials were down 1.5%. Now, the stock market rallied very strongly in the first part of the week, carrying off the rally last week on ceasefire expectations. Stocks were even rallying despite the 2-year and 10-year treasury yield inverting just for a brief moment. The reason given was a news story on Tuesday that Russia had agreed to reduce military operations near Kiev and that Russia was willing to speed up a conversation between Presidents Putin and Zelensky. The U.S. tried to cast doubt, and there were really no comments from the U.K. and Brussels that sanctions would be lifted. But regardless, stocks rose and materials and energy fell on that news. Russia also refuted progress later in the week. Inflation continues to be a hot topic as we get the core PCE price index for February this week, which showed a rise of 5.4%, the highest level since 1983, while the recent March employment data also communicated that the labor market is doing well with 431,000 new job gains and an unemployment rate at a post-pandemic low of 3.6%. With annualized earnings growth of 5.6%, a hot number that will continue to support a hawkish Fed. There's growing sentiment we may see 2 basis point hikes for the next 2 Fed meetings, as we anticipate the Fed will want to front-load, a term we've been hearing more of from Fed officials. Now, the 2-year and 10-year Treasury yields inverted, which means short-term yields were higher than long-term, and a topic that's likely going to continue to be a point of discussion in the months ahead. Now, normally the yield curve, a plot of the yields for various durations from short to long, is sloping higher from the highest rates earned for the higher risk of long-term paper. When the curve slopes down from short to long-term paper, it's said to be inverted. This is a result of demand going up for long-term paper, which drives those yields down, usually in anticipation of economic weakness on the horizon. An inversion in the yield curve tends to precede recessions by 6 to 18 months, and the stock market tends to discount the idea of a recession ahead as well. Now, the yield curve has inverted for all of the last 7 recessions, so it is fairly reliable as an indicator. One inversion in 1965, however, resulted in a recession 5 years later and was an outlier within the past 70 years. Now, the charts on some of the financial stocks, the ETFs and indices, don't look good right now and don't typically perform well when the economy is entering into the early signs of a recession when the yield curve flattens or inverts. Based on Sam Stovall's S&P's guide to sector rotation, the signs of early recession are falling consumer expectations, falling industrial production, peaking interest rates, and a flat or inverted yield curve. I'd say we're beginning to touch on those areas now. On Tuesday, at the first sign of the signal, Philadelphia Fed President Harker told CNBC that an inversion of the yield curve has mixed evidence regarding recession indicators, which I thought was curious given the data I just mentioned. Additionally, former New York Fed President Dudley said in a Bloomberg article Tuesday that a recession is virtually inevitable because the Fed is behind the curve, meaning the Fed is chasing runaway inflation. Another economic number that hit this week, a very important one, was the ISM Manufacturing Index for March, which continues its deceleration from a high it hit of May of last year and hit a new record low recently of 57.1. But since May of last year, we're now looking at a series of lower highs and lower lows in the ISM Manufacturing Index. Once it drops below 50, it's considered to be in contraction territory, so we're not there yet. But the deceleration is concerning. We'll get non-manufacturing data on Tuesday, which hit a high in November at 68 and printed just recently 59.9 in February. So it too has been decelerating rapidly. That wraps up the drivers this week in the U.S. markets. Up next, Robin Griffiths, this week's technician.
Marin Katusa, the founder of Katusa Research, joined FS Insider this week to discuss many of the key insights from his widely read and controversial book released last year, The Rise of America, Remaking the World Order. Marin also discussed the investment case for carbon credits. Here's a clip of what he told listeners this week.
I think carbon credits are going to be the sector of the next decade, 2 decades, and 3 decades. And it's going to be a massive, massive opportunity. The SEC has just mandated every publicly listed company is going to have to report their S1, S2, S3. That's scope 1. Direct emissions, scope 2, your indirect emissions, and scope 3, all your indirect and direct emissions. So that sector, I believe, has the biggest growth of any resource or commodity, in my opinion, today.
To listen to this full, wide-ranging interview that went about 50 minutes with Marin Kutusa, where we discuss commodities, nuclear power, geopolitics, and much, much more, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the market continues to rally, but there's a question, how long will it continue? Is this just a bear market rally? And is more downside ahead of us? Let's find out. Joining us on the program is Robin Griffiths from Trend Alert. Robin, in your recent piece, you talk about commodities, which we've seen go up. I don't care if you look at an oil, wheat, just about everything is going up. How long do you think this trend continues? And does it change if the war in the Ukraine comes to a peace agreement?
I think this trend does continue, particularly with the main commodities. In fact, gold and silver have only recently joined the commodity. It's really energy, food, and industrial metals. Those are very strong trends, and they have been now for over a year. My work effectively took me out of stock markets and put me fully invested into commodities quite a while back. I think the reason is commodities had had a long, long bear market. So they were coming off very low levels compared to other assets. Other assets had been pumped up by an awful lot of borrowed money. So before the war, we were finding the economy cooling down from a period when it had been pumped up on borrowed money. We'd got the rate of inflation taking off very rapidly. At the very same time that the Fed has decided we really got to do something with putting interest rates up. And that combination would, in all normal terms, give you a recession down the road in a few months' time and a bear market. And then you get Mr. Putin deciding, well, how about World War III? Will that help or not, basically? So I think that what we'll get is, if there's a peace deal done in Ukraine, and I hope there will be, probably within the next 4 or 5 weeks, then there will be a euphoric blip back up. But we blip back up into a bearish scenario. As it happens, two of my favorite American commentators have both come out recently with pieces that fit very well with my work. One is Jeremy Grantham, who long known as one of the best value investors on the planet, saying that the U.S. market had been pumped up into a hyper bubble. And if you eliminate the, 15-odd FANG-type super stocks at the top, the rest have been pretty sluggish for a long time. And then the other one, whose work fits very well with mine, is Ray Dalio. And I don't know if you can remember, but years ago when I was at HSBC, I used to publish work based on Schumpeter's model of economic cycles, in which the long cycle is called the Kondratiev wave. Well, in Mr. Dalio's work, he simply calls it the big cycle. And the way that goes is, Holland was a superpower, and then eventually Britain overtook the superpower, and then more recently, the U.S. have overtaken the superpower. And it is quite clear from Mr. Dalio's work that we've now come down to the U.S. still is the superpower, but it isn't unchallenged at the top here. And on normal form, you see the U.S. seniority slipping and being overtaken, at least in Asia, by Asia led by China. But even without China, there's still India and other places coming up. So I think the trick here is, having the dollar as the world's super currency, which always happens if you are the dominant superpower, that we're going to see that lose, because already China, India, and plenty of other places in Asia are absolutely fed up with doing all their trade through the dollar. And they have announced quite clearly that isn't going to happen. And unfortunately, more of the people live over there than live over here. So at least for more than half the world, the dollar isn't going to be the dominant currency. I don't know that, I mean, clearly for a Westerner, the dollar is the haven currency, but it isn't for an Asian person at all.
Robin, let's talk about the implications of that, because we have the petrodollar, where oil is denominated in dollars, and that's how it's paid for. But recently, we've seen that Russia wants to be paid in rubles. They're going to be doing trade with the Chinese in yuan and rupees with India. So what are the inflationary implications for the U.S. if that happens? In other words, what if the U.S. has to pay for its imports in other currencies?
I think what may happen, I don't think we're going to suddenly go to a world where suddenly it's the Chinese currencies taken over from the dollar. I don't think that's going to happen. I think we're going to go through a slightly more complicated thing where a lot of trade in Asia will be done in local currencies. In the Western world, probably the dollar will continue to be the dominant currency. And when America trades with Asian currencies, it may need to be willing to deal in, you know, swap arrangements or those sorts of things. I think one of the things is it was Saudi Arabia who agreed with, I think it was President Nixon, to create the petrodollar. And it is indeed the new king of Saudi who's already talking about dealing with China in Asian currencies. So if he does that, that is the official ending of the petrodollar, in my opinion. Now, this is, insofar as the U.S. is a continent, was Britain was only a little island in the North Sea. I mean, we've gone back to being a tiny island. Even when America's not number one, it's still a continent, a very big continent, and it's largely self-sufficient. So it's not going to disappear. Its economy will still grow. But it may or may... I think it's going to realize that quite a lot of its own design products are in fact made in Asia and places like that. So it's going to need to learn to trade in some other currencies as well. And I also think when you add in the demographic factor, I mean, the average baby boomer is younger than me, but not by very much. And he's now well into retirement age. So we're in the weak part of the demographic cycle. So in my work, and I think it follows on from what Ray Dalio is saying in his latest publications, we're going to see it slip from being the one and only dominant economy. And it's going to have to negotiate on a more fair basis. And putting it a bit more aggressively, the president ought to take himself out of Ukraine and ignore Ukraine and Europe, which has got nothing much to do with America now, and go off round to the Pacific Ocean, where there are developments going on which actually are a challenge to the USA. So really, America should be in the Pacific, not in Europe at all.
Well,
then we could give a peace deal to Mr. Putin, who is he's actually going back what went Mr. Bush Sr. promised him, the equivalent of a Monroe Doctrine. We won't put missiles right next to you. You took them out of Cuba. We're not going to have. And now they've gone back on it, trying to say we are going to do that. So we've got to let Ukraine be an independent, neutral country, not a member of NATO. It's allowed to be in the common market and be an independent country.
Yeah, as we see these geopolitical shifts, you're seeing more and more companies that have factories in China. Intel, a good example, bringing a factory back here. And Robin, it's more expensive to make goods here than it is in China. So isn't that inflationary?
Yes, is the answer. One of the very few bits that one can see quite clearly is that inflation is now currently running at about 7.5%, and it's universal. There's no country that can get away from this, and it's going up. Now, it's quite possible that in the long run, the oil price can't keep trending up because the world is trying to make itself all go electric and be bio-friendly and all of that. And the same would apply to coal. We really ought to leave these fossil fuels in the crown. But it's ironic, isn't it? Although we're all talking about global warming, we're now suddenly burning more fossil fuels at a higher price than ever before. The yellow brick road is not pointing in the right direction at the moment.
Well, let's take this a little further. So we have rising gasoline prices, which are taking money out of the pockets of consumers. We've got rising food prices. We've got real estate prices that just have gone nuts here. And you've got a slowing economy at the time. You've got inflation and the Fed raising interest rates. How do we avoid a recession?
I think we're not going to avoid it. However, if you use the inverting of the yield curve as a classic indicator, at the moment, the slope of the yield curve is changing, but it hasn't inverted yet. So what it's essentially saying is you've got recessionary forces coming down the road, but we aren't quite in them yet. What we've got is a slower rate of growth. But on current form, we look ahead, how long away is the recession? And what tends to happen is it's at least between 1 year and 18 months away on average. But on a very short-term condition, it's happened twice, about 6 months away is when it takes place. And I believe with the current conditions and the war situation, it's much nearer 1973 equivalent. So it's really saying by the end of the year, and certainly next year, there will be a recession and a bear market. And in those markets, which have been pumped up to very high levels on borrowed money, the reset has a good chance of being really quite big. Of course, they'll all go together, but I think the biggest fall will be in the most pumped up markets. And it's got nothing to do with how good the companies are. I mean, the classic one for me is Tesla. I have no idea how to value Tesla shares, but they seem a silly price, even though the company is a great company. It just, you can't value the shares like that. So they could come off 50% without even touching the sides. And I think quite a lot of extremely pumped up stocks are vulnerable like that, even though the businesses are, you know, going to carry forward. The good bit, though, is that when new technologies come in, they nearly always generate some more growth. And automation and artificial intelligence clearly is coming in. And the US is very well placed in this. Britain and Germany are also quite well placed in this. And of course, Japan is brilliant. So the benefits to those companies in those countries will, you know, they'll create a lot of growth. And probably what will happen is we human beings will suddenly wonder, well, all the jobs are being done by machines. Even the car drives itself these days. You know, what are we going to do? Go on holiday all the time? I mean, human beings will have to think out a new way to live. But it will produce a lot of growth. But some of the older industries, they're going to have to shed labor. The machine will do everything better than us. I can see this coming. I think this reset is going to be bad. So far in my life, the most frightening period for me was 72 to 74. I nearly went bust then because the bear market was that big, and nothing that's happened since then has been as frightening. But right now, the situation is pretty frightening. So in my opinion, and my own work is saying, it doesn't say sell everything and go only into cash. And it certainly doesn't say buy bonds. You could lose a lot on bonds. But it does say make sure you're firstly diversify widely. That's very good. That's one of the main points coming from Ray Dalio. Diversify widely and sensibly. And particularly if you're a U.S. investor, you're very heavy in the U.S. If you're a British one, you're very heavy in Britain. Make sure some of your money goes into some other market. Even if you don't like the people there, the idea is to divest geographically widely. And in my case, it certainly would be quite heavy in stocks related to these commodities, because the uptrend in commodities is very powerful. It's like a super tanker going flat out. Even if you tried to stop it moving right now, it's going to still go quite a long way, basically. One of the things that my own work has said is that cash was a bad investment. What's happened when I now rank the assets, cash has now come up, and it's better than neutral. It's not the top investment, but you're not being punished for holding cash. And if we were to go into a situation like 1987, where we came in one morning and found the whole market was down 25%, you know, only cash can hedge that. And as we're now not being punished for holding some cash, putting a few profits in the bank and sitting on it while we're planning further diversifications away makes a bit of sense. And if the period is going to have a crash, I think it's between now and October. For these coming few months, just being chicken but keeping the powder dry makes a lot of sense.
Robin, let's talk about bonds, because with inflation, Fed raising interest rates, people don't realize how much money they can lose by owning bonds. But what does this do to the 60-40 allocation, 60% in stocks, 40% in bonds, that's been in existence for half a century? I don't think it works going forward, do you?
No, you're absolutely right. It's been the classic investment, and for a long period of what used to be called normal time, it worked pretty well. But it's broken now. I think it all goes back to Mr. Greenspan when he started. He head off the downside risk of a Kondratiev wave by printing money freely. And on his watch, it didn't go wrong. On his successor's watch, it didn't go wrong. And then on the next, so we're now on the fourth Fed chairman, but I now think we've run out of wriggle room. When you factor in U.S. inflation, the real yield on a Fed bond, it's sort of minus 7% or something. It's clearly a crazy number, isn't it? It doesn't make sense. And as that's the most, ought to be the safest asset, if you misprice the safest asset, a lot of other mispricings will also take place. And so they don't become logical. Market prices, well, they're not logical. They become purely emotional. People see a Tesla car. They think it looks great. They love the man going to the moon or Mars, buy the shares at a price that cannot be justified with normal economic numbers. So I believe that the classic Western capitalist system, it's failing at the moment. And this is particularly important when you go to China. China has looked at the capitalist system, and they're pretty bright. They know what they're doing. And they just said, you keep your capitalist system. It's fine for you. But we definitely don't want it over here. We've got something created by Mr. Deng Xiaoping, and it's working jolly well for us. You don't want our system, but we don't want you. And unfortunately, the Chinese economy has now grown to the point, if it actually stopped trading with much of the West, it would take a hit, but it would survive it just fine. So in its own attitude, it's effectively saying, you have your continent over there on your side of the planet, and you do your capitalist thing. We don't need you. And this goes back to a document published by Mackinder. If you look at the map of the world, America's on the wrong side of the planet all by itself. All of the other countries are now linked up. And as Mackinder wrote, he says, if some country can unify that, it'll rule the world economy. And when you then look at the map and you put on it the bullet trains, the railways, and the shipping lanes that China has done right across linking up with Europe. Incidentally, a whole way along the top of those railway lines is Russia. Russia has to be part of that. It can't not be friends with China. And that is the Mackinder scenario. And what it does is it certainly gives an economic lead to Asia. It doesn't necessarily give them a military lead. I don't think, however advanced the Asian countries are, they're not on the same page at the moment as the USA, although I'm sure they're trying pretty hard to catch up, but they're not there yet. But economically, I'm afraid, China is in front. On the numbers I've got, it said it was 214 when the two economies were exactly the same size. If you talk to the firms of accountants that audit books all around the world, they're all telling you that by 2050, China won't just be a bit bigger than the USA. It will be 50% bigger. It's a much bigger economy. The average Chinaman will still be much poorer than the average American, but he'll be a lot richer than he is now, and they'll be enjoying it. And of course, by then, the Indian economy will be growing very well indeed. It already is growing well. I mean, Mr. Modi has made me an awful lot of money. I think when I talked to you earlier on, I bought the Indian stock market when their market was at 14,000, and it's been to 62,000. So we've done pretty well out of India. So these are the two giants of Asia, and they're going to have their walk in the sun. And the American economy will be relatively smaller, but it can't go back like Britain did to being a little island, because it is a giant continent. That's the difference. So it's not going to just shrink, but it'll have to be used to being number two. Eventually, when India picks up, maybe it'll be number three.
So as we close here, Robin, one final comment. What's your view on gold here? We've seen the industrial commodities take off. We've seen energy take off. And just recently, we saw gold take off, but then it's pulled back.
In my work, gold and then silver following gold came up much, much later than the other commodities. And the reason was they weren't performing like commodities. They were performing like money. They were a safe asset. Now, the magic level on my chart, which I published at lots, is $1920 an ounce. Once the gold goes above and stays above 1920, my work says we better own it. And it looked like that, but it can't at the moment. It's not being able to hold above 1920. However, the good news is if you plot gold in lots of other currencies as well as the dollar, it's going up in all of them. So I think it's just struggling with the fact that having gold and the dollar strong at the same time is a little bit, that's the problem, basically. So I would be adding gold to the portfolio, but I wouldn't be as keen on gold as I am on the other commodities. But really, food prices, industrial metals, those are a much easier bet for me. I see the future clearer for them, and I would be very long, basically.
So summing up, Robin, you see a great reset, and it's going to be, for most investors, a scary time, because if you take a look at the last 10 years, if you were in financial assets, stocks went up, bonds went up, people made money. That's not the clear case now, is it?
No, I agree. I think it, and it does, the trouble began when Greenspan tried this new idea. And to give him due, on his watch, it didn't break, and it's been working well, and everybody's copied him. So it's become the new thing, but it's now they're out of wiggle room now. There is no more wiggle room on printing more money. So I think what's going to happen is in the next month or two, there will be a breakdown. And as you probably know from my charts, the shape of a bear market on the chart is of a fall, which we've had, followed by a rally, which we're having, followed by the rest of the fall. And when we get the rest of the fall, let's say we come off 20%. At that point, I think you may find the Fed and other central banks saying, whoa, hold on a minute, let's not put interest rates up anymore. Let's print one more time. And then you'll get more inflation. But they'd be trying to save the market from going down too much. And if they fail, then I think on the most hectic markets, I'm really looking for an absolute minimum fall of 50%. So it's going to be a nasty bear market.
Well, listen, Robin, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the great work you guys do, how can they do so, please?
They can use my own email, which is Robin Bronwyn. That's RobinBronwyn @gmail.com.
All right. Well, Robin, as always, it's a pleasure speaking with you. By the way, are you doing any sailing these days?
I tried to give up sailing and go motorboating, and I literally yesterday sold the motorboat because I'm a sailor. Now, what I've done, you would know the boat. I've ordered a brand new 50-year-old boat. The boat is called a Contessa 32. They built some of them in Canada, but the main lot were built in Lymington in England, and I'm having a brand new one built now. And I'll get my hands on it in September. And the whole idea is I've got to go around Cape Horn on it, because I've been around the world. I've done every other Cape, but I haven't done Cape Horn. And the Contessa 32 is seaworthy enough to do that trip. It's the last thing on my bucket list, basically.
Well, I just did the opposite. I just got rid of my sailboat and went to a motor tug. So maybe I'll be changing that with fuel prices going up.
I've just found I need a mask and I need sales. It doesn't feel right to me otherwise.
All right. Well, listen, my friend, you take care.
Woody Prusel at 13D Research discusses the uranium sector, what we were seeing with ag and fertilizer prices, the Russia-Ukraine war, as well as to provide an update on the advancements and race to build the fastest and most powerful quantum computer.
The U.S. Defense Department has demonstrated the ability to deploy these 3D printed swarming micro drones from an aircraft. The drones demonstrated swarm behaviors, including collective decision-making, adaptive formation flying, self-healing. Last year, the Navy also conducted a record-setting effort where they simultaneously launched 1,000 unmanned aerial vehicles out of a C-130 and demonstrated these behaviors for super swarm employment. So that is certainly the direction that the militaries are heading.
To listen to this full wide-ranging interview with Woody Prusel, Senior Managing Director at 13D Research and Strategy, in addition to all of our other premium content airing 3 days during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
We're hoping that COVID is behind us, but we still have many governors passing laws, including the state of California, mandating vaccines. So we're going to talk about those vaccines today. Joining me on the program is Edward Dowd. He's a former executive with BlackRock. He's currently a hedge fund manager raising funds. Ed, can you tell our listeners a little bit about your background as we begin?
Sure. I began my career in 1990 at HSBC in the credit markets. I was an institutional fixed income salesperson. So I'm kind of an odd duck. I did equities and fixed income. So I have a wide knowledge of the capital markets and how economics work, currencies, interest rates. And then I transitioned to business school, Indiana University. And there I went to DLJ as an equity analyst. I spent 2 years there, right, in 1997 to 99. Saw the dot-com fraud live down the hall from me when I was at DLJ. And eventually transitioned to the buy side up in Boston for Independence Investments, where I was a tech and software analyst. I was able to see the bubble bursting and was able to parlay that success into a portfolio management job at BlackRock in 2002, where I joined a partner of mine and we grew the fund from $2 billion to $14 billion over 10 years. And then I saw the great financial crisis, real estate fraud, as well. So I've seen a bunch of frauds in my career.
So as we begin, Ed, there's a lot of stories about vaccines, their effectiveness, and adverse side effects, including death. What brought your interest, and is this a result of your knowledge managing a biotech fund?
I didn't manage a biotech fund, but we had biotech stocks in the growth fund. So I do have knowledge of healthcare. And my interest in this subject began in 2021 when, I didn't take the vaccine, not because I knew anything that I know now, but, I'm just someone who knew that Operation Warp Anything sounded like a little bit of a disaster to me, corners cut, safety protocols ignored. And then I also knew that it took 7 to 10 years for most vaccines to get the safety data needed. So my only decision was I'll wait. And early on, I started hearing anecdotes and all sorts of issues. And, statistically, I know that you're not supposed to be hearing anecdotes of adverse events and or deaths. They should be so rare that you and I should never hear of them in a normal, safe vaccine. So there was all sorts of things going on in the summer. And then I became horrified with the mandates and the what seemed to be this just momentum that was building to push this all throughout corporate America. And I became concerned. And then I became super concerned in the fall when a current biotech CFO who I used to work with, he was a healthcare investor, healthcare stock picker, told me that in a FOIA request, it was found out that Pfizer failed their all-cause mortality endpoint, which really wasn't made known to most of us when the drug was approved and touted as 95% effective. And that really got me suspicious. And I know that normally if you go before the FDA and you fail that endpoint, your drug does not get approved. And it was found out in the 28-day trial that 21 in the vaccine group died and then 17 in the placebo group died. So that's a failure of that endpoint. Wasn't publicized, wasn't made known to us. And then the FDA came out and said they were going to hide the clinical data for 75 years, which in my mind is prima facie evidence of institutional corruption at the FDA. So I started saying on Twitter loudly, fraud. And from there, my media voice was elevated through my affiliation with Dr. Malone. And I've been making rounds on different media talking about my investment thesis that Pfizer and Moderna likely committed some sort of fraud in the clinical trials. And so I think the vaccines are not safe. And unfortunately, I've been doing a lot of work on insurance companies and funeral home results. And in Q4, we saw elevated mortality across the board. And the insurance companies saw excess deaths in younger folks compared to older folks in working age population.
Last month, Ed, VARS reported a total of 1 million adverse events from the vaccine from December 2020 to January 22. 183,000 serious injuries and 24,000 deaths. Why do you think this information isn't more widely disseminated, number one? And number two, if the government knows this, especially governors and other politicians, why are they forcing these vaccines? California has a bill now before it in the next 2 weeks that in order to work in California, you must be, if you're an employee or you're an independent contractor, you must have the vax. That's one bill. The other bill is they're going to revoke the license of doctors who are using therapeutics to heal people of COVID. So given this information, why isn't it more widely disseminated that people could find out?
A couple things. My first thesis was that the advertising budgets of the pharmaceutical companies had infected the mainstream media, so they were suppressing it. Then we found out that through a FOIA request, I think The Blaze broke the story about 3-4 weeks ago, that most of the mainstream outlets, including Fox News and Newsmax, received funds from the Biden administration to basically promote the vaccines. And lots of pressure was put on producers to not book anybody that had an alternative narrative. So, you know, to be quite honest, I'm going to give some of these lawmakers a pass for now that they don't know. Okay, that's why I think this information needs to get out there. And I can say with confidence, the insurance industry, I've had a lot of people approach me quietly in the insurance industry telling me that I'm onto something and they're seeing some seriously adverse things going on in their numbers and they are starting to become very concerned. So I think we're going to see a battle between pharma and the insurance industry, which looks like the bag holders at the moment. So stay tuned. This is starting to heat up. And I think you're going to see news breaking in the next several weeks about this. So the good news is I think we're going to hear more and I think it's going to get out there. And the mainstream blackout blockade on this information should break. But I'll give these politicians a pass for now, but not much longer.
So what have you learned, Ed, since you started your investigative thesis into possible fraud involving Pfizer? Anything that surprised you the most, whether Pfizer or otherwise?
So when I started to get media play, a whistleblower by the name of Brooke Jackson reached out to me because I was strongly using the word fraud in my investment thesis. And it's an investment thesis. So, you know, that's why I was one of the first people to say it. And she said I was the first person she heard use the fraud words. She came to me and I interviewed her for 3 hours. And she broke her story in November at the BMJ, the British Medical Journal. She gave them all the receipts. So they vetted her. So I didn't have to do a lot of vetting because they vetted her and they came out. Now, the story was suppressed by the tech overlords, a lot of censorship. They removed the story. The British Medical Journal was quite shocked that they were censored because they're an old line institution that goes way back with a lot of credibility. What I found in my 3-hour discussion with her, and then she and I went on a podcast together, was this. And I consider this the smoking gun. The fraud, she told me, overwhelmed the ears, but I focused on one thing. And that was in her 1,000 patients of the total 44,000 in the clinical trial. She was the director of 1,000 patients, regional director in charge of making sure the study ran well. She discovered that the patients in her 3 sites were unblinded, the 1,000 patients. When you unblind patients, the data should be thrown out. Her subsequent data was rolled up into the total study. And when she discovered this, she made her firm, Ventavia, which is the subcontractor for Pfizer running the clinical trial study. They basically asked her to participate in a cover-up, according to her. Then she went to the FDA in the morning, filed an anonymous whistleblower complaint, and by 3 that afternoon, she was fired. And why this is important is that the clinical trial study, the 95% efficacy that we all heard about in November when they announced their results, was predicated on a 28-day study, 28 days. So that just boggles the mind right there. There was 8 in the vaccine group that got COVID and 164 in the placebo group that got COVID. So why that's important is it doesn't take a lot of patients in her 1,000 to affect those results. So 75 patients that the doctors didn't test for COVID because they saw on the chart that they were vaccinated, and that could definitely happen because of bias, would reduce the efficacy to 50%. If there were 164 of her 1,000 that weren't tested for COVID, it dials it down to 0% efficacy. And let's be quite honest, you know, and I know that where there's smoke, there's fire. There's probably other sites that were compromised. But with just hers, it calls into question the whole clinical trial study. So that's why I'm so confident in my thesis.
Recently at a WHO summit, the head of Bayer Pharmaceutical Division admitted that this mRNA vaccine is an example of gene therapy. Any comments on that?
Well, I don't know if you remember, but I remember there was a bunch of people that came out and said that early on. That was censored. People were deplatformed for saying that. We were told that that was lies and that this was not editing genes. There's been some studies that have come out that it does actually, some peer-reviewed studies, that it does actually change the DNA in the liver. And the fact that he said that out loud, and I believe he said, we never would have been able to convince people to do this unless we call it a vaccine. So, you know, as time progresses, this is getting more and more disturbing to all of us. And it appears that through either willful ignorance or greed, power, corruption, whatever, you know, good old classic greed and power, it seems this could be the greatest scandal of our lifetimes.
You know, one of the things that really strikes me with these vaccines, it was called warp speed. And typically, Ed, my knowledge of vaccines, they take 8 to 10 years to develop with clinical trials. We did this in about 12 months. But under the Emergency Authorization Act, you could put these vaccines out there if there wasn't any therapeutics that could solve the disease. And we know with hydroxy and ivermectin, I had the Delta variant of COVID, and I was treated with ivermectin, got through it, never got temperatures, didn't have side effects other than fatigue. Why was Fauci and company, and especially the government, so adamant against ivermectin and hydroxy? And they made them sound like experimental drugs when they've been out 40 to 60 years.
You know, as we roll through time, the evidence is starting to mount that there was a concerted effort to suppress early treatments so that the EUA could be authorized. And the results of that, we're starting to find out that potentially 400,000 individuals in year one of the pandemic didn't need to die. Okay, so there was this willful potential conspiracy to suppress this for vaccines to come on the horizon. And you know, look, you and I have been in this business a long time. The revolving door in Washington, we've seen it. And I think there's just a ton of corruption that's been in Washington and at the regulatory agencies for quite some time. And unfortunately, with this scandal, it's not just financial issues, it's lives. So this is a twofold fraud, financial and health. And it's really upsetting to me. And that's why I'm such a blunt force instrument to get people aware of this. And I hope through my work, people figure out what's going on and we can break this mainstream media blockade soon.
Any thoughts, Ed, about the Pfizer documents? You know, they did a data dump out there by a court order. Anything in particular catch your eye when you looked at that data?
Well, so that data came out. It's 55,000 pages. And rather than me try to look at that, there's been some people. Naomi Wolf is a journalist, and she has crowdsourced with about 2,500 lawyers and scientists and doctors the data, and she's going to be putting out a preliminary report soon. But her early indications are it looks like massive a disconnect between what Fauci and the CDC were saying about safe and effective versus what the documents are showing, that basically it was an experiment and the adverse events and all of the safety data that should have been known to us was ignored or suppressed. So that there's going to be a report from her coming soon. I would pay attention to that. She's doing great work on that.
Do you think, Ed, once this information becomes more widely disseminated, because, I mean, there's been so many news stories that have been called fake news, and a year later, turns out they were true because of media suppression. But once this news comes out, do you think you see the politicians back off, like, for example, these governors, including our own in California?
I absolutely think that. So here's the problem. In past frauds, like the dot-com fraud, we had, you know, regulatory agencies step in, unfortunately, after the fraud occurred and the damage was done, but they were there to step in and investigate. This time, unfortunately, the government is involved and they are in cover-up mode. So there's really no one coming to save us from a regulatory standpoint. So what I believe has to happen is the politicians have to become aware of it, and then they turn on their pharma partners that give them PAC money, and through just sheer numbers of people outraged, this becomes a political thing, and that's how we break this, and that's what's going to need to happen.
Yeah, because, you know, little by little, this news has gotten out. I have two family members that now have heart problems as a result of the vaccine. My friends have been vaccinated. They all got COVID. One has had to have tumors removed from the arm that was jabbed. So little by little, Ed, this information is getting out there. You know somebody that had an adverse effect or somebody that died of the vaccine. One of my doctors that I deal with told me that they're not allowed to report this stuff at the hospital. What do you think that is?
Yeah, so I've been hearing all sorts of things going on in the hospitals, and something happened to healthcare that I'm 54, I'll be 55 in a couple weeks. Healthcare was different when I was growing up, and I think for you it was as well. I think since Obamacare, hospitals have become run by the administrators, and the whole doctor-client relationship has been blown up, and there's medicine done by technocratic, bureaucratic decree. And a lot of these doctors, especially the younger ones, don't know any better. And I don't think they're bad people. I think this is the system they've been introduced into, and they think that's just how it is. And they don't see the fact that what's going on is absolutely and utterly wrong. And I think from the get-go, there were monetary incentives put in place to identify someone as having COVID. Then if you admitted into the hospital, you got money for that. You got money for admitting someone to the hospital. Then you got money for intubating them. And I'm not saying that people willfully did, but the system pushed that. And these hospital administrators, they get paid their bonuses based on the money they collect. And so it's really gross. We have whistleblowers. I live in Maui. We have whistleblowers in Hawaii who have stepped forward and said that, you know, they've had people die in their elderly people die in their system, and they didn't die of COVID. But, you know, as the month quarter end would come up, they were told to change the billing code to COVID because they got more money for a COVID death. So there was this perverse incentives put in place from the get-go that kind of pushed the system towards this outcome. And so doctors are scared because the administrators are basically dictating what's going on. So that's why you're hearing stories about doctors that aren't allowed to report these things.
I want to talk about how this pandemic was handled. Fauci, we all remember the wash your hands, wear gloves, and it turned into wear masks, then it turned into wearing vaccines, and then shutting down the economy, where literally the government put us into a recession, destroyed hundreds of thousands of small businesses, and then basically created a large unemployment problem. In response, we've seen $6 to $7 trillion of stimulus money come into the economy while we're reducing supply. And the result, Ed, is I'd like to get your comments here, is we are now facing the highest inflation rates that we've seen probably in half a century.
You know, that's super interesting you bring that up. So since 83, when we see inflation and commodity prices go up, we typically have a corresponding rise in short-term interest rates. This is the first inflation since 83 that we haven't seen that. That's because there is a monetary effect, but this is mostly a supply shock. This is the worst kind of inflation. We have the monetary phenomenon, and we haven't seen the interest rate rises yet. They're coming if the Fed can do that. I'm not sure. I'm still suspicious they'll be able to do that, but this is a disaster in the making.
And this is one of the first times in knowledge in my career, Ed, that we're actually seeing the Fed tightening when the economy is slowing down. Normally, they tighten when the economy is heating up, the economy is expanding rapidly, giving way to some inflation. This time, it's almost the reverse. The economy is beginning to roll over, and they're tightening into this cycle. That's number one. And number two, the thing that concerns me is the massive, and I mean massive amounts of debt levels out there at the consumer level, the corporate level, and at the government level. I just don't see this ending well.
Right. And I don't know if you've been following the dollar, but the dollar bottomed sometime last year and has been slowly rising and accelerating. And over the last 12 years, there's been tremendous amounts of borrowing overseas in U.S. dollars. So a rising dollar is, in my mind, evidence of tightening credit conditions. And then we just had the yield curve, I guess, invert recently. So there is a storm coming. Most of my friends who are super smart at predicting economic movements at hedge funds, that's what they get paid to do, are looking at a recession in Q3, an actual negative GDP number in Q3. So it's all conspiring to make for a very ugly summer and fall. And we just had President Biden basically say several days ago that food shortages are coming. So I've never seen anything quite like this. I'm shocked.
Yeah, because and I've been told by some of the doctors that you might want to stock up on antibiotics because they come from China, and here shortly we may not be able to get it.
Yeah, I was a young kid in the 70s, and you know, I don't remember it being bad, but I was told it was bad, but everything was fine in my mind. But I think this is the first time many people alive today are going to see shortages of things you need. And, you know, I'm particularly scared that the bubble and everything is going to pop. And we're going to see financial assets where inflation has been running rampant the last 10 years in that area, inflation and financial assets. I fear we're going to see financial assets go down and things we need go up. And it's a 1-2 punch.
Given this, you've got large hedge fund managers like Ray Dalio. They're saying that I would not be in cash given what he's seeing. If you are in cash, you know, let's say you get 1% on CDs or money market funds or even treasuries, and you've got 8 to 10% inflation, you're still losing money.
You know, people are asking me, I don't like to give it financial advice, but the one thing I am saying to people is, look, I know inflation is running hot, but if I'm correct, and I believe I'll be correct on financial assets deflating over the next year, having a little bit of cash in your portfolio, what we call dry powder to buy when things look really stark at the bottom, is not a bad idea. And Ray Dalio has been super wrong on his calls about cash is trash. Every time he says it, there's usually a market top. those of us on Twitter and FinTwit, we make fun of him. We've been doing that for years. So, you know, cash is trash, but cash also has a use. It gives you opportunity and flexibility. So, having a little cash on hand is not a bad idea to take advantage of the bargains that show up, that I think are going to show up over the next 12 to 18 months.
Ed, I heard you mention recently in an interview that soon you'll be taking a backseat to someone regarding the Pfizer or COVID-related information. Can you share why that is and when we could expect to hear something from this person?
Yeah, so I alluded to that earlier. So basically, when I started to get a media profile, I said I wanted to be a lightning rod and that I was going to be reviewing insurance company results. Well, someone brave reached out to me, former number one II-ranked Wall Street insurance analyst, who's no longer on Wall Street, but he basically helped me analyze the results. And he's decided to come forward in his own way. And he will be doing that soon to an audience that matters. And his name will eventually leak, but you can surmise what audience that'll be. And there's going to be, hopefully, an industry solution and media hype about what happens in the next couple of weeks. So, you know, I'm hoping that I take a backseat, but he did inform me yesterday that I probably won't, and he wants me to help. So we'll see what happens.
Well, even as successful as you have been, you certainly must be getting some pushback as you have been anything but silent. Ed, why did you go public with the information about Pfizer and the other information you have shared in your discovery? I guess, what's in it for Edward Dowd?
Nothing. I also want to say that publicly, I am not short these stocks, Pfizer and Moderna. I knew that I would be a lightning rod and that people would want to attack my thesis and saying that I had an axe to grind. This is just the right thing to do. So I am not going to make any money on this. I hope other people do. I hope hedge funds do. I hope people on Wall Street help me expose this fraud. But as a lightning rod, I knew that I might be in a situation to get whistleblowers and create news. And I just don't want the government coming after me saying that I was doing anything nefarious, and it's to protect myself and to kind of be bulletproof. You know, short sellers always get a bad rap because you have an axe to grind. Well, my axe to grind is to do the right thing, and that's all I'm doing.
So given this, as this information gradually comes out, what do you think is going to be the backlash when we have been just pounded relentlessly by the media, by government, mandatory vaccines, and all this information has been suppressed either by the mainstream media or social media? I mean, literally attacking people as quacks that even question any of this. Because, Ed, you know, one of the things that struck me is when the lockdowns came, I could go to, let's say, Walmart, Target, or Costco and not get COVID. But then I could get COVID if I went to the local business establishment.
Yeah. So I think there needs to be a RICO investigation. It seems very suspicious that we had to shut down small businesses in America, but big box stores where many people could aggregate and potentially get COVID if COVID was really that deadly. To critical thinkers like yourself and myself, it made no sense then. And it's becoming more apparent that something nefarious might have happened. That we can have commissions and truth and reconciliation later about that. The goal right now is to prove the fraud at the vaccine level. And if I can do that and other people can do that, this whole house of cards falls apart. The sad thing is that the bodies are piling up and the injuries are piling up, and it's becoming undeniable at this point. And I can say with confidence, as I said earlier, the insurance industry is starting to wake up, and they're feeling like bag holders right now.
You know, I think I heard in one of your interviews that in the fall of last year, I think the number of deaths of millennials was at 61,000 or something like that.
Yeah, let me talk about that. So my insurance industry, Wall Street number one IA ranked fellow and I, we looked at the Q4 insurance results, and then he was looking in the CDC database for something else. We were just looking to see if all cause mortality death was continuing into this year. And what he discovered was that he was able, the CDC doesn't break it out by age. They lump it all together into just all ages. but they provided the data. So he was able to, through some work on his own, extract that data by age and create his own baselines because he has actuarial training. He created analysis of different age cohorts. And when we were looking at it, what struck the both of us was looking at the millennial cohort, because if you looked at the all-cause mortality in that age group, 25 to 44, it looked like a growth stock chart. It went to a high at the end of 2020, dipped a little bit, went to a higher low, then accelerated to a higher high, then a higher low. And then into the fall mandates, it literally, the rate of change accelerated, and it was striking. And so we looked at the numbers, and between March of 2021 and February of 2022, 61,000 millennial excess deaths occurred, which is essentially a Vietnam War occurred in the millennial cohort. And if this public policy had been working, the millennials never should be seeing deaths go to new highs, excess deaths. They should have been trending towards baseline, but that wasn't occurring. So, that's when we came to the conclusion in our minds that the smoking gun of vaccine acute death injuries was in the millennial age cohort, because a couple things. They're younger. They are not susceptible as susceptible to COVID as the older cohort. And that spike into the fall mandates was so rapid and fast that it can't be explained by what a lot of the naysayers will tell me is, oh, well, people are, committing suicide because of the lockdowns. People are dying of fentanyl and opioid overdoses, and people miss their cancer treatments. Well, that age cohort doesn't go screen for cancer. And I would argue and debate with anybody to tell me that in a 3-month time frame, August, September, October, when the millennial deaths accelerated, I would like them to argue with me that everyone decided in a 3-month time frame to commit suicide and overdose. So the rate of change is the signal. It's the smoking gun. And that's why I keep hammering that on every show I go on, hoping that somebody in Congress calls me and my partner up to testify. We'll testify if anybody wants us to, and we'll defend our data.
And does it really surprise you? We have this wonderful invention called the internet, the dissemination of information, access to information. Do you ever think that you would see the day where the large tech companies would be censoring? I mean, it's almost like you live in the Soviet Union. You say something, as you are doing, I don't care if it's a politician or it's a doctor, Dr. Malone's, others have been censored. They've lost their jobs. But widespread censorship, what about the backlash against social media companies?
So when this is all said and done, I've labeled this a meta fraud. And why I call it a meta fraud, it's multi-siloed. So we have the fraud started with Pfizer, and then that could only happen with government complicity, FDA. Much like the great financial crisis with the rating agencies being corrupted. So you have the government involved, you have Pfizer and Moderna involved, and then you have the media companies, both MSM and social media involved, and they were inundated with, I guess, federal dollars and, as we found out recently, and advertising dollars. And I also think the tech folks wanted to participate in what I think they were trying to create, the COVID economy. I think they were excited about surveillance technologies to make sure that we complied with our quarterly boosters and all sorts of goodies and ancillary businesses that would pop up around this COVID economy, so to speak. So it's a multifaceted corruption. And I will say, and I've said publicly, that they're accomplices to murder when this is all said and done.
So going forward, if you were to look out a year from now, describe what you think will unfold.
So the implications of this are stark, as you can imagine. It basically causes massive loss of trust in all of our sacred institutions, regulatory bodies, government, media, and healthcare. And it's going to be chaotic, because the folks that are involved in this are not going to go quietly, and they're going to cover it up. So it's going to take a real grassroots effort. If the current politicians, both on the red team and the blue team, don't listen to us. We have to vote them all out, everybody. And this is really just kind of a marginal mind, convincing the marginal mind that you've been defrauded at a very, very deep level and that we need change. And the change is going to be painful. It's not going to be violent. I'm not calling for violence. It's all going to be done through just classic grassroots American individualism and efforts, team efforts. So that's, I think the next year is going to be very painful. You know, there are some of us aware of what's going on. I'd say about 25% of the country knows what's going on. And we just need another 10, 15%, and then we can really get some steam building to change.
So as we conclude here, Ed, if people wanted to follow your work or keep up on this unfolding event, what's the best way to do so?
I am currently on Twitter at Dowd Edward, D-O-W-D Edward, and I'm on Getter at Edward Dowd, D-O-W-D. And I don't have a website yet, but some of my friends secured some domain names and we're setting one up. So hopefully I'll have a website soon.
Ed, I'm surprised you mentioned you're on Twitter. They haven't censored you yet?
No, they did. They suspended me for 7 days when I really started heating up, but I don't know why they didn't blow me up. I'm expecting to be removed at any moment.
Thanks, Edward, for sharing your research with our listeners. We always try to bring different viewpoints on the show so our listeners can decide. All the best to you, and please come back again as your research discovers new information.
Are you getting closer to retirement? Do you worry about what retirement will look like? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help put your mind at ease. Our advisors can help customize an individual retirement plan that fits your needs and helps you get on the right track to achieving your retirement goals. We'll show you how to get the most out of your Social Security benefits, make the right decisions on Medicare, reduce taxes, and increase your return on investments so you can relax and enjoy your retirement years. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Joining us is Chris Poplava, CIO of Financial Sense Wealth Management. And Chris, as we've been discussing on our Smart Macro segment here on Financial Sense NewsHour, we started getting concerned about the market late last year. You were positioning defensively, raising cash. How has that played out so far? And what is the outlook as we enter Q2 since we are now on the first day of the second quarter?
Well, so far, you know, when we look back at the first quarter, we did expect some weakness and we certainly got that, more than a double digit correction. Some parts of the market, like the NASDAQ, entered bear market territory, falling by 20% or more. What we did not expect, although we did expect the trend to be seen in terms of rising interest rates, was the degree and the veracity of the rate move. It's been very, very dramatic. Luckily for us, though, we were underweight fixed income. Our portfolio, fixed income wise, is on the shorter side of maturity. So, you know, that did help us. Being underweight equities also helped us. But one of the areas we discussed, especially in our client letter, was that we'd be looking for some attractive areas to redeploy if we had some weakness, such as increasing our exposure in overweight to energy, as well as in convertible debt. And we certainly saw a whole host of opportunities, particularly in the fixed income side. The Fed now moving towards an interest rate hike last month, we have been seeing credit spreads widen, which means that debt on credit products like corporate debt, both investment and junk bonds, have widened such that their valuations have improved. And so we have started to put some money to work in short-term convertible debt where, you know, we're getting north of 4% yield to maturities with the option to convert to equity if the equity performs well. If it doesn't, you know, we're still looking at over 4% yields to maturity on the bonds that we were acquiring over the last quarter. So that's attractive given the environment that we're in right now. We also increased our exposure to energy. We still think there's a real supply-demand mismatch in the energy sector, and we expect energy prices to remain sticky and elevated. But looking at how we closed the quarter, we were a little bit surprised by the strength of the rally that we had in the final few weeks of March. A very strong and robust rally in a short amount of time. And in light of what we see ahead of us, that we see plenty of headwinds abound, we felt that it was not yet time to turn bullish. And in fact, with the rally that we had in equities at the end of the quarter, we put on a hedge for our equity clients to reduce our exposure because we are concerned about weakness ahead with the headwinds that we see coming. So very much the way we entered Q1 of this year is how we're entering Q2. We are still on the defensive side of the ledger.
So starting in 2020, we started making a pretty big call to expect a big wave of inflation. And you had said over and over that inflation would likely line up on the persistent side. Because of that, as you mentioned, we had pared back on our bond portfolio, given the expectation that we would see a pickup in rates as inflationary pressures emerged. And also, as you mentioned, already having an overweight position to energy and the material sector. Does that about summarize what we've done so far?
It does. We did have a lot of cash on the fixed income side of our portfolios, which we did put to work in some convertible debt issues. Definitely increased our exposure to energy and some other niche areas. But, you know, for us, we don't feel like we're out of the woods just yet. And because of that, on balance, we still remain below neutral risk levels at this time.
Now, I think we're all familiar with the levels of uncertainty that are out there with the Russia-Ukraine war. Inflation continues to head higher. I guess we are seeing a little bit of some pressure taken away when we look at oil prices now back around $100 per barrel with the massive historic release of strategic petroleum reserves. It's going to help a little bit at the pump, but most of the analysts that I'm following are saying that it, you know, maybe shaves off 35 cents from the overall gas price, and we will likely see it move back up as we head into the summer driving season. So not going to necessarily translate too much to gas prices. But what are some of the things that you're looking at for why you don't think, you know, we're out of the woods yet for the second quarter or beyond?
Well, I think there's definitely some headwinds facing the economy. And a lot of it is just the opposite of what we were facing 2 years ago. 2 years ago, inflation collapsed, which meant that consumers had more discretionary spending. It also meant that profit margins for corporations were elevated. And we also saw a decline in interest rates. So it made financing of appliances, homes, cars, you name it, the low interest rates, low inflation was very stimulative. But what we're starting to see is that being taken back with the dramatic rise in interest rates and inflation in general. For example, one of the trends that we have been picking up on is the significant jump in 30-year fixed rate mortgage rates from, you know, a year ago, we were looking at below 3%. We're now pushing almost 5%. So we feel that that's going to, and it has been, leading to a slowdown in new home sales. So a year ago, new home sales were averaging roughly around 30 to 40% growth. And that is now decelerated, where sales right now are negative, meaning they are lower than where they were a year ago. So we're already starting to see some of this transpire. And, you know, if we see rates persist where they are or even go higher, I would expect both new and existing home sales to continue to decline. And while housing is not a major percentage of the overall economy, it definitely is indirectly when you think about everything tied to housing, whether it's building products, you know, Home Depot and Lowe's and the sales that are derived from there. It definitely indirectly is a good portion of the economy. So a slowdown in housing would transpire to a general slowdown in the economy.
Now, Chris, one of the big items of note this week was the 2-year U.S. Treasury rate going above the 10-year. So that is the 2-10 yield spread has now inverted. That's probably the most widely watched. And this means that the clock has now started for, on average, anywhere from as little as 6 months to about as long as 2 years. We could see the onset of a recession once we see the 2-10 invert. Is that your understanding of the situation? And basically, where would you assess the risk of a recession?
Well, the 2-10 does have a pretty good job of predicting recessions. If we look at a shorter spread, such as 3-month versus the 10-year, that typically inverts later and has less of a lead time in terms of recession. So there definitely is, you know, I mean, you're looking at 6 months to 2 years, that's potentially a very long lead time. And you don't want to just see something dip into a certain threshold for a day or two. You want to see it persist there to have more of a strength of the signal. But what will be interesting was one of the comments we made to clients in the first quarter would that it would be kind of the Fed would be in a difficult environment because when it was doing tapering or ending QE in previous periods, it was doing so at, when bank lending was not exactly robust. And so we felt that the Fed undergoing tapering and ending QE At the same time, we were seeing accelerating growth in lending by commercial banks would kind of cause the Fed to, you know, push a little bit further and harder than it thought. But when we look at where things stand today with the yield curve, the Fed very much well continue to push rates higher as it's battling high inflation, which is a lagging indicator. So when we look at the inflationary trends that have already been in place based on past price increases, we could see the Fed continue to play catch up and possibly push even the 3-month 10-year yield curve into an inversion and possibly risk recession going into 2023. That would definitely or could possibly be the case if we see persistent and elevated oil prices. Typically, whenever we've seen oil prices double in short order, often at times we're followed by a recession soon after. So if we continue to see elevated oil prices, a central bank that is tightening liquidity conditions by raising short-term interest rates above long-term, we might also exacerbate that by seeing bank lending really pull in. So, you know, a possible slowdown in housing, slowdown in bank lending, plus consumers, you know, basically getting hurt at the pump with high oil prices, it definitely could create a lot of macro headwinds, I think, going into next year and later this year.
So obviously that's the message that you are giving to clients right now is that macro headwinds abound, as you wrote in your Q2 newsletter.
That's correct. You know, there's definitely a lot of headwinds that are building. You know, we are starting to see it become common news. For example, when we look at the ISM numbers, you know, those have come down from the elevated levels we saw late last year. And when we look at certain industries, for example, the CEO of FreightWaves, Craig Fuller, he was commenting on what he's seen in the trucking industry, and he actually believes a freight recession is imminent.
And just to clarify on that, when he says that he believes a freight recession is imminent, is that translating to an economic recession as well, or are those separate?
Possibly. I mean, they are interrelated. So freight is, you know, basically trucks moving goods to and from around the country, and that's based on demand. So if the consumer is purchasing, retail sales are strong, you're going to have, you know, freight being moved across the country to restock inventories. But when the consumer weakens, then you would expect to see freight weakening. And that does kind of dovetail his comments on the comments that we got from the CEO of Restoration Hardware this week, Gary Friedman, whose comments actually were really making the rounds and kind of causing quite a stir. To quote him, he said, "I'm not trying to scare anybody, but either businesses are going to make a lot less money or they're going to raise their prices. And I don't think anybody really understands how high prices are going to go everywhere. In restaurants, in cars, in everything."
Yikes. I can see why that was getting a lot of attention. In addition to Gary Friedman's comments, as you noted in the recent quarterly newsletter that we'll have posted on Financial Sense this coming week, you also pointed to a chart and some data. I believe this is from Nielsen IQ, looking at consumer intentions to spend. Do you mind sharing what message is coming from this when it comes to the Q2 outlook and perhaps for the remainder of this year?
Sure. When we looked at the survey that Nielsen performed looking at consumer spending intentions for this year over the next 12 months, there is a very clear pattern that emerges. And essentially, they're looking at spending more on essentials and less on discretionary spending. So the highest category that where they expect to spend more money on is groceries, utilities, education, and childcare, the rent and mortgages. And the areas where they're looking at decreases are out-of-home dining and eating, out-of-home entertainment, holidays, international travel, clothing, apparel, domestic travel, gym, sports, club memberships, home improvement. So clearly, the necessities such as food and shelter and utilities, those are taking precedence over discretionary spending. So it will be very interesting to see how that plays out in retail spending for this year. But it appears as though that study, which was done prior to this year, is already bearing out when we hear the comments from Gary Friedman at Restoration Hardware that their business is starting to see a weakness in consumer demand.
So again, Chris, it sounds like the main message here is that we're looking at a number of macro headwinds for the second quarter and for the remainder of this year. As you just mentioned, I mean, consumer intentions are really, inflation is hitting consumers hard. We know this to be true. It's something that we're all experiencing, regardless of where you live in the country or even the world at this point. Some places seeing massive rampant inflation in emerging markets with food prices. That's actually expected to even get worse as we go through the remainder of this year. But consumers are paring back on their spending expectations, and that is a problem because it could lead to a self-feeding cycle and bring about an eventual recession, as we talked about a little bit earlier. One last section that you discuss in your client newsletter, which again, I do want to recommend all of our listeners to check in on. If you go to Financial Sense, you can see where we post this material. You talk about liquidity headwinds. What is it you're looking at here?
Well, one of the things we're looking at that was a huge development last year was the financial firms pouring into the Fed's reverse repo facility. So the repo market is one in which the Fed can both have stimulus and remove stimulus in terms of repos or reverse repos. And what we saw was a huge jump where the reverse repo market grew to over $1.5 trillion. Now, that in a normal time would have been a huge weight on the market in terms of a loss in liquidity. However, it was offset by what the Fed was doing with QE. So we didn't quite notice that. What I'm concerned about is we've got the reverse repo facility quickly approaching $2 trillion, getting basically to the highs that we saw late last year. At the same time, the Fed is now done with QE. And in fact, the Fed is moving from quantitative easing to potentially quantitative tightening, where they're shrinking their balance sheet potentially in the coming months. So, you know, that's a huge loss of liquidity for the markets, you know, good support that was driving risk assets higher. And further than that, when we look at the global scene, when we look at global money supply as measured by M2 priced in dollars, that peaked year over year in the mid-20s, 20% growth range in the fall and summer of last year. And it's been decelerating ever since to now roughly around 10% year over year and continuing to decline. So that definitely is a concern for valuations, for risk assets, when we see liquidity both here in the U.S. and abroad begin to shrink. So, you know, until we see some of these headwinds reverse, you know, our opinion for this quarter, as was last quarter, was a defensive stance is warranted.
Chris Poplava, Chief Investment Officer for Financial Sense Wealth Management. Chris, thank you again for coming on our show. Keep up the great work, and we look forward to speaking with you in another 2 weeks.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.